Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from Real Ghost Stories Online, inviting you to subscribe to our other podcast called The Grave Talks. It's where I sit down and interview individuals who've had extreme paranormal situations happen to them in their lives. Just search The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe and give us some stars to help spread the word that this show exists. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of The Grave Talks. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted St. Albans Sanatorium. There's never any guarantee that you're going to find anything on a ghost hunt. Investigators often scoff at televised ghost shows and their enormous amounts of evidence that conveniently is just found just in time for the cameras. If you ever decide to enter the haunted St. Albans Sanatorium seeking to find the proof that you're looking for, it may just be your lucky day. Originally constructed as a boys' school during a time when hazing, which is part of life and academics, St. Albans Sanatorium saw its first years brimming with adolescent energy and poor choices. After falling on hard times and better education options in nearby cities, the school closed its doors. The building was then resurrected into a sanatorium in 1916. At its time, the medicine and procedures practiced were thought to be very advanced for the day. In the perspective prism of history, though, they looked more like cruel and inhumane ways of treating the mentally ill. Today on The Grave Talks, we talk with paranormal investigator Jake Fife about the history of and his experiences at the haunted St. Albans Sanatorium.
Well, the building was built in 1892 by a man by the name of George Miles. And he wanted this building that could create a group of gentlemen that would be perfect for 20th century business. He wanted to create the next generation of leaders, and where he was at the time, he didn't feel like his vision was being met. And so he went to Radford, and which at the time was still called Central Depot, and he found this little land up on a ridge, and he thought, you know, it'd be perfect. It's away from the town. They won't be distracted by, you know, getting into hijinks or getting into typical things that teenage guys typically do when they're away from home. And so he started construction on the building. And he collected some of the finest professors and teachers on the East Coast that he knew. And this was, when it came to that area, there weren't many places like this, aside from a college. Now, this was not a college, it was a prep school. But what's interesting is, in a lot of records, it's listed as being a high school, technically designated. But during their athletic competitions, they would go up against high school and college school. So that's something that's kind of cool. And with him, he took somewhat of a militaristic mindset to, you will do this. This is the discipline. But it wasn't a military school. So it was kind of strange how he had it set up, very different, but it was very ahead of its time. He had many different sports, really any sport an athlete could want to play. He had them there because he wanted to create the perfect balance of strong mind, strong physical body, and of course he wanted classic Southern gentlemen. So I guess in his mind, he had this vision of what will the perfect gentleman of the 20th century, 20, 30 years from now, look like. And that's what he tried to create with this building. But over time, it started to get a reputation as a very rough school. This wasn't some place where, you know, it was a nourishing environment. He kind of let the students rule themselves in a sense to where if there was a squabble, if there was a feud, anything like that, he just let them deal with it amongst themselves because he figured if they learn how to solve their problems amongst themselves, they'll be better men in the long run. But of course, that didn't happen. There are a lot of stories that come out of there saying that there's multiple suicides, maybe even some accidental killings. I have found no records to prove this, but that's a story that I've heard. But the fact that it did have a very rough reputation, that is true. That is documented. And something he would do, him and his wife, they would go to different cities, different towns, all over the East Coast, mainly the South. And he would recruit the best athletes, the best minds. And he dove completely headfirst into this school. He gave everything into it. And eventually he figured out, you know, in order to operate what I want to operate, we need more funds. And they weren't getting the funds that he liked. Now, the school was very profitable. A lot of the high astute families of the region, they sent their kids there. And it was considered a big honor and a huge deal if your son went to this school. And at that time, it was known as St. Albans Lutheran Boys School. And so him and his wife, they would go to different towns and recruit these people to send them there. And after a while, he figured out that athletics was starting to catch on huge in Virginia at that time, mainly baseball and football. In fact, in, I believe it was 1895 or 1896, they had this pitcher for their baseball team that was known as the best baseball pitcher on the East Coast of America, which was a huge deal. There's a few, I've read newspaper articles written about him. But he started pushing athletics a little bit more. And what that did was that created a bit more of a hostile environment, because there were people that, you know, they weren't as intelligent as some of the higher class kids that were being sent there. But they were, in a way, being given run of the school because, you know, they were making the money. And as long as they were making the money, they could kind of do what they wanted. And so that's when you had stories of hazings come into play. Some people supposedly committed suicide. There was actually, this is in a yearbook. You can go online and read this. It's from 1894, 1895. But there's a quote from one of the staff members that said to this certain kid, I can't remember his name, he didn't return to school for the second semester, much to the dismay of his classmates, because he featured predominantly as the football of their local games. So it was a very rough environment. But after time, I guess he saw the writing on the wall that, you know, there's other schools that have somewhat taken his model and have improved upon it. And so some of the higher class people that were paying, you know, the larger tuitions, they started pulling their kids out. And around 1903, he's starting to look at other towns to move to. He doesn't really want to be in Radford anymore. And so around 1910, 1911, he decides to go ahead and close the school. And right after that, he kind of disappears from record. I have not found anything about, you know, what he ended up doing. I did see one mention that he might have gone to Nashville. But between 1892 and 1911, there really wasn't anything in the early 1890s around where the school is today, where the sanatorium is. It was a road, and that was kind of about it. There might have been a house or two every so often. But once the school was built, it really started developing that area. And that was very, very key for not just the town's economy, but also the county's economy. Because if you go by there now, that's a very busy road with a lot of businesses. And that was started pretty much because the school was put there. And then, of course, you had the sanatorium, which came in 1913. Actually, that was started by George Miles. I've got the names mixed up. But he was a director of another local sanatorium, and he had a different vision for treating people that were, I guess, mentally handicapped. He didn't really like the idea of having people, you know, strapped with these crazy machines that would shoot electricity into them or anything that he saw as inhumane. He thought that being outside, doing something, working your mind slowly back to where, you know, it might be at a level that may be deemed normal by their standards, that's what he wanted to create. And he designed this huge facility that was going to be, I believe, at the Southwestern Mental Institution. And what he wanted was this big facility that had gardens, tennis courts, and pools around. And his idea was, this will not be worked by just staff members, but mainly by the patients themselves. We will give them, you know, little jobs. They will earn an allowance. While they're getting treatments on the side, we have them, you know, doing kind of typical work that a worker of the time would do. And his idea was, you know, slowly over time, their mind might go back to a normal level or how they deemed was normal. But the problem was, when he pitched this idea to the Board of Supervisors, it cost a little too much money than they were willing to spend. And so they basically shot his idea down. And there was even one mention that said, you know, if their mind is broken already, why should we even try to fix it if it's going to cost us this much money? And so he got mad. He got ticked off. And he ended up resigning. And he still wanted to set up his own dream facility. But he couldn't find a place. And so him and his wife, they were traveling, looking for really anywhere, any vacant property to start building his dream. And then he stumbled into Radford. And when he stumbled into Radford, it was originally going to be, you know, just a quick one-off trip before they got back on the road. But he saw the abandoned building up on the ridge. And for some reason, it caught his eye. And he couldn't take his eyes off of it. He couldn't take his mind off of it. So he took all their remaining funds that they had in their names, and he bought the building and started working on it, trying to restore it to where, you know, he could house patients. And so he created this little board of directors, and they raised actually a decent amount of money for, you know, kind of just being thrown together on the fly, not really anyone knowing what exactly they were going to do. And so when he first opened it in 1915, it only had less than 30 patients when it first opened. And the numbers really didn't climb the first few years. And so what he ended up doing was, it was half sanatorium and half hospital. And one of the main things that he also noticed was, in the local area, the clinic wasn't the world's greatest. And the closest hospital was about 20-some-odd minutes away in Christiansburg and Blacksburg. So he figured, you know, for the time being, this will bring in some money and it will help people, you know, spread the word of mouth around the state. And it worked a little bit, not to the point where he wanted it to work. But then something happened. There was a local arsenal that was built. And once the arsenal was built, he started getting more patients. Now, the reason for this was, when you're working in an arsenal, and these people, they worked really long shifts. And I cannot remember the name of the chemical, but there is a chemical that when you are exposed to it for long periods of time, it messes with your mind. And it kind of makes you go a little crazy. And so, you know, people would start acting weird, and they would send them to Dr. Miles up at the sanatorium. And after that happened, their numbers tripled out of nowhere. The problem with that was, they didn't have enough nurses, enough staff members to take care of all these. And of course, George Miles and his wife, they were almost bankrupt, to the point to where, in order to get food sometimes for their family, they had to take food from the gardens and from the cows and chickens that the patients at the sanatorium next door were raising, and they would sell them at local markets. That was how tight it was. But him and his wife, they never wavered in their belief of what they were doing. And slowly but surely, it started becoming a straight-up sanatorium. Now, he ended up dying in the 1920s. And after he died, his wife kept a watch on it, but it was kind of more of just, you know, Mrs. Miles. That was kind of how was. She didn't have full control of really anything. And this new board came in, and they started coming up with new ideas. Now, at that time, the eugenics movement was starting to pick up steam in Virginia. And some early forms of eugenics was used at St. Albans. But when the Stanton, the Desjardins structure, was built, that kind of took over most of their eugenics stuff. And St. Albans Sanatorium pretty much just became a sanatorium that would experiment with some of the latest ideas and theories. about, you know, how to care for the mentally weak. And that's when you had the more experimentation, more experimental messed up stuff like hydrotherapy, some advanced forms of electroshock. But they didn't hire more doctors and more nurses. So you would have a few thousand patients, but you may only have between 50 to 100 people on staff, which it sounds like a lot, but the way they did it to try and save money, it didn't work out. And so you had a lot of people that were neglected. They didn't have their needs met. They weren't tended to when they needed to be tended to because there was some other experiment that needed more staff on standby. And so you had a lot of people that died these really tragic and sad deaths.
I hope you enjoyed your 15-minute preview of our new podcast, The Grave Talks. Be sure to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download podcasts to not miss any episode of the show. New episodes every single Monday. Just search for The Grave Talks and then press subscribe. Give us a review while you're at it and some stars that will help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that the show exists to make an even better show for you. The Grave Talks. Check it out at thegravetalks.com.